This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Everybody.
Oh, it hurts.
Oh yeah, because it really is the last one.
It is truly. Yes.
Got it.
No, okay. Come on.
Okay. Hi, Resolvers.
We're sorry.
Oh.
Oh my gosh.
Crying already.
We are, because we're so tired mostly.
Mostly because we're exhausted. It's been a long recording day, but we're doing it for you.
We love
you. Because we had to finish out the season.
We had to. It's good.
It's not you. It's us.
Yeah, for real.
It's definitely us. So welcome back to part 2 of season 4, episode 25 of Resolved Mysteries.
The very last episode.
Oh my God.
The last one. If you're new here, you're a little bit late to the party because it's our very last epi. But this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And no one here is sleeping. Nope. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. We love you. We're going to say it so many times this episode.
We love you so much. Don't forget, we do have one more nonprofit for our very last month, and it is the Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy. And you should write a review, one last review, so that donate those dollars.
I mean, the pod is still going to be around, and I guarantee there are people listening who have not heard every episode. So, still leave reviews because new people can still find the show.
Right.
I have listened to several, like, inactive podcasts, so no worries. Yeah. Just in case a listener is like, what's the point of leaving a review? If they're like, oh, the podcast is ending, but no, you still have a whole back catalog.
Right, and the content, we'll never pull the content.
It lives in the ether, yeah.
Sure. Okay, what are we going to be talking about today in part 2?
I have a Lost Loves about Robert Bobby Brown.
And then I have the unexplained death of Chaim Weiss.
Okay, let's do it for the last time.
Let's do it! One more time, we love you. All right, our last Lost Loves. Here we go.
It's sad.
It's sad. So...
Man.
Ugh. You guys.
Okay.
This always happens. It's like always a massacre or the child death.
Okay. Sometimes a lost love's good. Sometimes sad. This segment opens with upsetting images and video of the Dust Bowl, which is a whole part of American history that I had not thought about for a very long time. And it's very sad and very upsetting. So Stack describes the Dust Bowl as one of the most devastating natural disasters in American history in the 1930s, turning much of the country into completely a barren wasteland and making so many families have to move to find work, abandon their homes, and just leave and often never come back, which is so sad and also very interesting to think about how different. Like, I love to think about things like that, and if that hadn't happened in history, there is definitely so many people that would have never been born or whatever because people would have not moved to a certain part of the country to meet it's just interesting.
Yeah.
The whole country would look very different if that one thing hadn't happened, which is the story of any little thing that happens. Yeah. But it was a very big, big, terrible thing that happened. Mm-hmm. So in this case, Bobby Brown, Robert Brown, is who we are looking for. And the Browns, the family, had relocated to California after their farm in Oklahoma was destroyed during the Dust Bowl. So by 1951, the Brown family had 4 children, and Dora, the mother, was pregnant again. On July 27th, 1951, she gave birth to twins, Martha and Robert. Due to financial difficulties and heart ailments that Martha had, one of the babies, Dora and Ira were forced to give up their twins for adoption, even though they had four children already. You know what it's like to watch a kid grow up and you have to give two babies away because you truly can't care for them.
It's so sad, but it honestly was the best decision they could have made.
Like, it's just an unbelievable decision, to have to make.
Yeah.
So the twins were placed in California's foster care system, and they were taken from one home to another for several years. So finally, in 1956, Martha and Robert were still together, and they came to live with Arnold and Alice Breitler of Reedley, California. And there's a reenactment of this, and the family seems, like, very sweet and welcoming and, like, they're excited to have the twins come live with them. Alice is a talking head in this segment, and you can tell she's old by this time, obviously. You can tell she really cared about the kids and has a good heart. Honey. She's such a honey. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's so sad.
It's too sad. So one of the things she says is that she remembered she had toys ready for them, just like two little things, like a truck and a stuffed animal or something.
Mm-hmm. A doll.
Yeah. A doll, yeah. And the kids were so excited to have them, and they played with them for a long time. And it wasn't until later did she realize they had literally never had toys before of their own to play with. And she would come to find out that the kids had not been treated well in their previous foster homes, causing probably immense trauma.
Right.
One of the clues for that is that Alice remembered the kids had large amounts of dirt on them, and it took her over 2 hours to clean it all off.
That's terrible. I mean,
those kids were not being bathed at all.
No. And then the kids were just always eating.
Yes.
And so they had not been fed well at their other foster homes. Eventually, Martha began to tell Alice how she and her twin brother were mistreated. And one example is that at their previous foster home, the twins were told to stand outside while the family ate their dinner. And then they were invited back inside to eat just beans.
Yeah, which were probably like canned beans.
Yes.
Like,
but also, which, what the fuck would do that?
Why are they having to stand, even if you're not going to feed them the same meal, which is barbaric, why are you making them go outside?
Like, what kind of monster?
It's
a monster.
Fucked.
So even at their new home where they were really well cared for, the kids had learned this pattern of sneaking into the kitchen at night to take food. And they were in fear of going hungry again. So that's something that Martha and Robert would do almost every night and just sit in the kitchen and eat, even at Alice's house. So Martha, one of the siblings, says, Bobby and I were very close at the time. It was like we were the only kids in the whole world who loved each other and nobody else loved us.
Oh my God.
So definitely some like out of survival, codependent trauma bonding happening between, plus they're twins. So it's just like this
Next level.
Yes. Next level of a bond.
Literally the only constant in your life.
Yep. So these kids have been basically neglected by foster families for 5 years, which it's so sad because their birth family never wanted that to happen. They trusted
the system.
They would have not made this choice if they believed their kids would be living this life.
Right. Yep.
But that kind of neglect can have an effect on kids' behavior, of course. And so one day, Alice is washing dishes, and she has set up a pool for the kids. She's looking out the window, and the kids are having fun and playing. And then she realizes that Bobby, or Robert, is holding Martha's head under the water and not letting her come up. So she runs outside, and she scolds him and helps Martha. And she's like, this boy needs help that I can't give him.
Yeah.
And I think this is just one example, but there had been other like behavioral things happening in the home. Of course, also it's the 50s, so nobody knows anything about trauma or
there's no
what happens in the
this.
Brain.
Of course not.
No, and like she has to be thinking like that he could kill his sister.
Yes.
Like, she wants to make sure that she's okay.
Yeah.
It's so terrible.
So Alice is like, I need some help with him. So she contacts the child authorities, but it was decided that for Martha, the sister's safety, the twins should be separated, which you can tell that that's not really what Alice meant or wanted by asking for help.
Right.
So in 1957, Bobby was picked up from the house, and it's unclear if, like, he knew that he was never coming back, and it's unclear if Martha knew. But before leaving to get in the car with just this stranger social services person, he runs and gives Martha his clown costume, which he had worn out on Halloween that year, and it was, like, his most favorite thing ever. Mm. And so he runs and gives it to her, and probably he did know that he wasn't going to see her again, which is the saddest thing for a little honey to have to process. And that's the way he deals with it, is by giving her something, which is like a very adult thing to do.
And I'm just glad that they allowed that stuff to be shown and, like, hearing from her about how she felt he loved her and stuff, because he wasn't just an evil kid.
No.
He had this, like, anger inside of him he didn't know what to deal with
because
of what happened to him.
Yes. So Alice, their foster mom, says, I felt so bad, and even to this day, I wish I hadn't sent him away. Mm. Yeah.
And she was looking for help. She wasn't looking for, like, removal.
Then she changes her sentence, and she says, I'm sorry that they had me send him away.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
But that was all social services seemed to know how to do at the time. It's just like, keep separating, keep putting in a new home, like, not actually deal with helping. But also, education was very different then, and psychology and all that was very different. So when the twins were 11, Robert and his new foster family moved out of the area, and Martha, Arnold, and Alice never heard from him again. So in 1962, Martha was legally adopted by Arnold and Alice, and after Arnold, the father, passed away, Martha and Alice moved to Ashland, Oregon. When she was 18, Martha went to the welfare office in Fresno, California, and she learned that Robert had been adopted, so she obtained his address. And she was graduating that year and knew he probably was too, but she wrote him a letter asking if he would come to her graduation. And so she checks the mailbox every day, hoping he's writing her back. And then a few weeks later, she gets her same letter returned, unopened, and it says return to sender. Mm. So he's obviously has not seen or opened her correspondence to him. So then, a long time later, in 1989, Martha obtained copies of Robert's birth certificate and driver's license. And she found that he had had an address in Los Angeles. But when she looks more into what the address is, it's a homeless shelter.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's called the Midnight Mission. And so she's able to go to them, and she's, like, asking if they know who he is or if they've seen him. And they say they have not seen him since 2 years before in 1987. It is just
that
terrible.
Is, like, the least thing that you want to find when you're
and she was excited. She was like, I found an address for him. And it's the worst case scenario for an address.
Mm-hmm. And I know I say it all the time, but, like, once again, this is sometimes how people become homeless. Don't fucking judge anyone.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're not just lazy people who don't have jobs. Oh, they're sometimes people who are fucked over by the system.
Yeah, they have no fallback. He had nothing to fall back on. So Martha is, of course, on the show hoping to find Robert along with her other older siblings that she's never met, which I, like, forgot about. I forgot she also has this four other siblings.
Yes. Same.
So there is a little bit of good news. So within minutes of the broadcast, Martha was put in contact with her oldest brother, Jack. But unfortunately, her other brother and sister had died already. Not Robert, like just the siblings that had been born before her. Martha passed away at the age of 44. In 1995.
And the fact that when she found those siblings, they were two out of four were already deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What?
is right. It's that. Like a Santos thing. That is right. True. Is there some
what the
genetic
heck?
Thing going on? Right. I know.
That's three very young people.
Right. Yeah. So she dies in 1995, just 3 years after the airing of this episode. And it's not known if she ever reunited with Robert. The other family had not, like the other siblings had not reunited with him. And so his name, though, was listed among her survivors in her obituary, which is so beautiful.
Aww.
And then from what people could find, records say that he later went by Robert Harold Macy, and he passed away just a year after her. Twins.
Wow.
Again, so crazy.
Oh my gosh.
All of the siblings.
I know. In 1996. So he would have been 45.
Mm.
It's so sad. No resolution. I mean, she got to know her older brother, Jack. It doesn't seem like her parents were still alive.
What the hell?
And she really wanted to find her twin. And if he had not been taken from this home, who knows how different his life would have been. And who knows what his life ended up like.
Well, exactly.
So that's sad.
It's terrible.
Okay, sorry, love you. If you, all the other last, most of the other last loves are very nice in case you're just now listening.
Yeah, if you need to just rewind a few eps.
Go back to another episode. Yeah.
Okay, so the final segment of season 4, episode 25, the final episode of Resolved Mysteries, is a really lighthearted segment about, just kidding, it's about a young boy named Chaim Weiss. So Robert Stack opens the segment in a synagogue. Synagogue Stacks starts the segment by saying, "America is God's crucible. A great melting pot. These words, written nearly a century ago, are as true today as they were during the Great European Migration." I didn't know this, but the Great European Migration was one of the greatest migrations in human history. From 1846 to 1940, 55 million Europeans sought a new life, mostly in the United States and South America.
Wow.
55 million people.
That's wild.
Wow.
So Stack then goes on to say that, quote, "woven into the colorful fabric of American society, a few subcultures are so self-contained and tradition-bound that they are shrouded in mystery. To those in the mainstream, they are all too often misunderstood. Members of the Orthodox Jewish religion comprise only about 0.1% of our population." Stack says their roots may be traced back 5,000 years to the time of Moses. "Observant members of the Orthodox Jewish community live according to strict codes of social and moral conduct, which have remained unchanged for centuries."
Uh-huh.
What could go wrong?
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
Stack says that hours of daily prayer and rigid dietary regime are among the ancient rituals which guide the members of the Orthodox Jewish community through birth, marriage, and death. Stack says that to ensure the continuation of tradition, many communities have established yeshivas, schools which include an emphasis on religious and ethical principles of Orthodox Judaism. At 8 a.m. on Saturday, November 1st, 1986, Don Daly, a veteran Nassau County, New York police detective, was dispatched to a yeshiva in Long Beach, New York, to investigate the murder of one of its students. The victim was 15-year-old Chaim Weiss of New York City. This says New York City, but then I also read that he was from Staten Island. A single blow to his skull with a sharp object had severed his spinal column, but he actually was hit 3 times. You know, one of the times is what killed him.
Yeah, okay.
The investigators found no murder weapon, and there was no evidence of a robbery or signs of a struggle. Detective Daly says that initially they were dealing with this murder being discovered on a Saturday, which is Shabbat. They arrived at 8 a.m. and it was difficult to talk to anybody because the Orthodox Jewish community can't write on Shabbat. So they couldn't take statements from anyone. Shabbat is observed from a few minutes before sunset on Friday evening until the appearance of three stars in the sky on Saturday night. Technically, there are 39 actions that you cannot perform during Shabbat. One of the items on the list is, quote, writing two or more letters, hence not being able to take a statement. However, I would like to caveat that by saying that there are permissions allowed to break Shabbat, such as another human being's life being in danger.
Yeah.
So Detective Daly can't get a statement because it's Shabbat. But he also says that he thinks that the students were afraid to talk to him. Stack says, in the victim's room, Daly found a series of clues which indicated that the killer might have been familiar with the yeshiva and the customs of Orthodox Judaism. It appeared that Chaim had been killed as he slept. His body was then moved twice, first from the bed to the floor, and later to another spot 2 feet away.
Mm.
It also seems strange that Chaim's window had been left wide open on a chilly October evening. Daly says that law enforcement spoke to several people who were involved in the Orthodox religion and that they were told it's customary to open a window or a door to let the spirit of the deceased out.
Mm-hmm.
He says that he was told it would also be customary for the body to be taken off the bed because the body should be at the lowest point or the coolest point in the room. Stack says another ritual would result in a third peculiarity. One of the rabbis asked to leave a memorial candle in the room. The crime scene was then sealed.
Mm-hmm.
However, 2 days later, another candle mysteriously appeared. No one in the school ever admitted to having placed it in the room. Daly says that if that person lit the candle in a gesture of, I love this quote, in a gesture of sympathy or love or, quote, hi.
Oh,
why wouldn't they come forward and say that? With little else to go on, Daly set about piecing together the final hours of Chaim's life. He learned that Chaim was an outgoing, likable teenager who was at the top of his class, and he had been attending the yeshiva in Long Beach for 2.5 years. Anton Weiss, Chaim's father, said that Chaim was loving, joyous, and bright, which I think is, like, such a beautiful...
Yeah,
that's nice.
He says that Chaim didn't have any problems and felt comfortable at the school, but maybe there were some things going on that are normal among kids. Stack says that in 1986, Halloween fell on a Friday night, the beginning of Shabbat. In the late afternoon, Chaim left classes with his friends to attend services, and afterward, he would return to the dormitory. Several hours later, two classmates saw Chaim reading in the hallway, which is something that many students do because during Shabbat, they can't turn the lights on and off in their rooms. So the lights are always on in the hallways.
Yeah.
Shabbat has a lot of loopholes.
Well, yeah, I had the same thought. Like, it's okay for the hallway, but it's not okay right. for the room.
And,
like,
you know, I mean, these rules were created 5,000 years ago.
It's modernizing in a,
So, Chaim Weiss was last seen alive at 1 a.m. Police speculate that the killer knew the layout of the dormitory and was aware that Chaim was one of the only two students in the whole building that didn't have a roommate.
Mm.
Daly says that no one heard anything unusual that night, but there was one student who heard his door open up sometime during the night and then close again. The student assumed it was the roommate, or... maybe it was someone looking for Chaim.
Mm-hmm.
Daly says there are a lot of questions they haven't been able to answer. And I his energy in this segment of trying to just want to do anything is so heartbreaking. And he's also like, I want to help you. Why don't you let me help you? You know, right. Like he can't understand being stonewalled like this. So Stack says, a few days after the murder, Daly called a meeting with the students, teachers, rabbis, because he was so desperate for information. And he implored them to come forward. But almost every question he asked was answered by stony silence. Daly learned that in the Orthodox religion, unless you have proof, you can't discuss someone who you believe may have been involved in a crime or a bad deed. So, no one could discuss who they might suspect or if anyone was threatening Chaim or anything about how they felt because they couldn't provide proof. And this is where I'm like, I'm wondering what exactly is UM doing? I'm assuming that Daly called the show because no one in this community.
Who's going to come forward from the show? Right.
Right. Police eventually polygraphed 40 of the school's students, teachers, and rabbis, and they did not get any useful information. And then poor Daly is basically like, please come forward and say something. Anton Weiss says that not knowing who murdered his son makes it difficult to cope. He says that he accepts that his son is dead and the murderer is still loose, but all of the unanswered questions makes him feel very uneasy. And yeah, the community could not be smaller. It's 0.1% of the population in a neighborhood in Brooklyn. The person that killed your son is absolutely in your synagogue.
Yeah.
What is that like?
Yeah.
Stack says that one question above all others continues to haunt this case. Why would anyone brutally murder a 15-year-old boy with no known enemies?
Yes. It's just so shocking.
Right. And then, ugh, this is where it's like full on, come on, UM, be quiet. Police believe they may have one significant lead. A jogger says that he saw a young man who could have been a yeshiva student blocks from the school at 7 a.m. on the day the body was found. All attempts to identify the student have been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
That is not a clue.
No. No, it's truly not.
Existing outside the building isn't any relation to the case whatsoever.
So there's no update. So Chaim Weiss was the first grandson of a Holocaust survivor, his father, Anton. He was born in a displaced persons camp in Germany after World War II.
God.
A few years after the crime, Chaim's family got an Easter card addressed to Chaim that said, "Know what happens to chickens when they get too old to lay Easter eggs? They die.
What the fuck?
D-Y-E. Happy Easter."
Oh, my God.
So.
Okay.
As you can imagine, there are so many pages of the internet dedicated to this case. It has all the trappings of a true crime rabbit hole, the mystique of a close and relatively unknown religious sect, a child murdered in his school, in his bed, and positioned, quote unquote, ritualistically, law enforcement being completely stonewalled by the religious community. The internet loves this story. So I always love to go to the Unsolved Mysteries message board because in this case specifically, it was batshit. Like, people are out of their minds. They're talking about satanic sacrifices and
just, oh, God.
I did find two interesting comments there, so I'm going to read those. So a user named Avram said he studied at a parallel yeshiva and took an entry test at the Long Beach yeshiva right after the murder. And this is his quote. "I think all the talk about Jewish traditions in this case is garbage and not connected to the case. The window open, the body on the floor, has nothing to do with religion. Perhaps to do with the murderer wanting to hide the body until he realized that it wasn't possible. Opening of the window definitely had nothing to do with the soul, and perhaps the murderer was thinking of throwing the body out of the window or hiding the body until he realized that he couldn't or thought otherwise. People who murder don't all of a sudden become experts in Jewish traditions."
I mean, unless they were Jewish.
That's what I thought they were saying.
Yeah.
I was also like, was the window open because that's how they left?
Right. Well, that everyone kept acting like it was a locked room mystery. They were like, there was only one entrance and one exit. And they're like, and the window was open. It's like, well, that's solidly a second exit. What are you talking about?
Even if it was at a high level, it's New York, there's probably a fire exit. Like,
Avram goes on to say, if the murderer was one of the students, someone other than the murderer would definitely know in the school setting. The yeshiva and the boys of the yeshiva at the time would have figured it out in a millisecond, especially a murder. The school, the rabbis, and the students, and it would have been common knowledge among all of the students who studied there at the time. He believes that the students truly didn't know who murdered Chaim, and he also doesn't believe that a rabbi did it. He thinks that maybe nobody knew who the murderer was because the person wasn't actually any of the actual students or a member of the staff, but the person was familiar with the school. And then this was a really interesting comment that someone, the username was MLB Alumnus. He had a pretty shocking story. So he said, I attended that school 3 years later. While there, I heard from older students about there having been what would be viewed in the Orthodox world as a problem of homosexual liaisons between certain students. I heard further rumors that the victim had somehow been involved in it. Years later, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, there was a divorced fellow attending the same yeshiva who had left Mesiva of Long Beach, which is that yeshiva, which was Chaim Weiss's yeshiva, before I attended. One night, he invited me to his parents' vacation apartment near downtown Jerusalem with the offer of a, quote, normal American dad for the night. He shared that he had been good friends with the victim, which is odd, given the age difference. It would have been at least 10 to 15 years. He told me that he had been divorced because his wife accused him of sexual deviance. He had adamantly denied such accusations and even refused to divorce her for a long period. Isn't that nice when someone's like, no, you have to stay with me. He had the support of top rabbis, as his father was a known, successful, and influential businessman in the Orthodox world. Later that night, at his apartment, he sexually assaulted me. I told him that if he did not speak to his mentor at the yeshiva within 3 days about his behavior, then I would. He acted like he had no idea what I was talking about. So I realized I would get nowhere because it was his word against mine. A few years later, when we were newlyweds, my wife and I met this person when we were leaving a store in upstate New York. The person asked me why I did not invite him to my wedding. I told him that he knows why, but if he insists, I will tell him in front of my wife. He acted completely clueless and dumbfounded, and we quickly walked away from him. Fast forward about 19 years, and I saw him at the wedding in the same town in upstate New York. He was not sure if it was me and was eyeing me from afar. I nearly vomited right then and there and got the hell out of there. In my mind, a character like this guy could have easily killed Chaim in a crime of passion, yet pathologically compartmentalized it to the point that he referred to him as a friend.
Oh, my God.
He did the same to me.
Oh, my God.
Also, QM left out a ton of information. So there were a lot of very important events leading up to Chaim's murder, not mentioned in the segment at all. So I read that Anton Weiss said, so I only found two articles. That's how little information there is. So I'll post the articles in the episode notes. One is from Jersey, one is from New York. That they're not big papers. They're really nothing. The papers aren't nothing, but the articles are very. The papers are doing God's work, so give them money. So I read that Anton said that in July, a few months before, so Chaim was killed in October on Halloween. Chaim was attending a summer camp at the yeshiva, which he had done every single summer since entering the school. He apparently loved the summer camp and had never complained about going before. I think the summer camp was in upstate New York, so it wasn't in Long Beach. You know, it was in the quote-unquote woods. Anton said that one day, Chaim called him, and I can't remember the word, the quote, but he said, basically, Chaim was in tears, super upset, and he said that he wanted to come home immediately, right away. He wasn't happy, and he needed to leave. But Anton was on vacation in Florida. He basically was like, hey, buddy, I'm going to be home really soon. Hang in, and then we'll talk about it when I get back. And a lot of kids call home upset.
Yeah. Get homesick or whatever, yeah.
When Anton got back, he went up to the summer camp and visited Chaim. And Chaim was totally chill. Everything was fine. Anton said, hey, are you okay? And Chaim didn't even really talk about it. Like, high energy, super happy, wanted to stay. So he stayed for the rest of July without any kind of incident or issue. A couple of weeks after the crying incident, the principal of the yeshiva, Rabbi Avram Cooper, called Anton Weiss and asked to speak with Chaim. So that definitely happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the principals of schools are always calling to talk to your kids.
No.
Oh, what the heck?
Anton asked why the rabbi needed to speak to his son, and the rabbi gave a vague explanation. Anton told the rabbi that Chaim was away in Europe visiting his grandmother and that he would be back in a week or so. So the rabbi called back a week to the day.
Ugh.
And Chaim was still away, but it seems like Anton felt like the rabbi was so desperate for a conversation that he and the rabbi set up a time for Chaim to go visit the rabbi's house and speak with him when he came home from his grandmother's. So, and the timetable is very loose because I don't know what the school schedule is for a yeshiva, but I think this is like maybe late August, early September. Anton and his wife drive Chaim over to the rabbi's house. When they get there, the rabbi tells them that he wants to speak to Chaim alone and that they should wait in the car.
Nope.
And they do.
Yeah, because you trust a religious leader.
Right. Chaim was inside the rabbi's house for about only 10 minutes and then came back out, got into the car. Anton asked Chaim what the rabbi wanted to talk to him about, and Chaim said that he didn't want to talk about it. And he was very quiet on their drive home. Later that day, Anton asked Chaim again what he and the rabbi had spoken about, and Chaim got a bit frustrated and said he really didn't want to talk about it.
Oof.
And to please not ask him again.
Hmm.
So Anton didn't. Obviously, in an interview years later, Anton said that he heavily regretted that decision and he should have pressed Chaim to get the information out of him, but he assumed that Chaim would tell him when he was ready. So the New Jersey news station, WPIX 11, found the former principal, Rabbi Avram Cooper, living in Lakewood, New Jersey, where he's retired. Lakewood, New Jersey is a very Orthodox Jewish community right by Point Pleasant in South Jersey. Quote, when we asked Rabbi Cooper about Chaim Weiss's call to his father from camp in July of 1986, he waved his hand and said, I'm not interested in speaking about this. When we persisted, Cooper said, more emphatically, I said I don't know anything about it. When we started to ask about the parents' claim that they drove Chaim to Brooklyn for a meeting between the principal and the student 6 to 8 weeks before the murder, Cooper refused to respond to our questions, walked into his house, and shut the front door.
Oh, my God.
Anton Weiss remains upset about an encounter he said that he had with Rabbi Cooper in court when the Weiss family sued the school for failing to safeguard Chaim. So they sued the school. They were like, wow. My kid lives here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good for them.
Yeah.
Anton told WPIX 11 that Rabbi Cooper suggested to him that he reflect on any bad deeds he may have done as a way of considering why bad fortune may have come to the Weiss family.
Gross.
Quote, "It shocks me to today," Anton Weiss said. "What do you think? I stole something? I did something? I killed something?" So, like, not only is that a super fucked up thing to say to any parent of a murdered child, mm-hmm. but, like, it also kind of sounds like a threat a bit.
Yes.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Like, why don't you think about what you were doing
mm-hmm.
when your son died and maybe wonder if it was your fault? So the Weisses sued the school for $15 million and they settled out of court for an undisclosed sum. And in my mind, they should have gotten a jajillion dollars because uh-huh. what happened to Chaim is appalling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's pretty clear that Chaim was being sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
Many theorize that Chaim was being sexually assaulted by a student whose parents were very influential in the community.
God.
And that the murder wasn't, like, covered up, but basically
no one spoke, yeah.
Right. There was also in the, I don't know if it was in the UM segment, but there was a janitor, and he was seen arguing with Chaim. And then also there was a mentally disabled, houseless person in the neighborhood, which obviously are red herrings. How would, I mean, a janitor maybe could have worked his way through and knew that Chaim was alone, but what kind of person is going to murder a kid, move the body 2 times, go through all this stuff because, like, the kid won't clean his bathroom? I don't even know. And no member of the houseless community in Long Beach, New York would ever be able to work their way through a yeshiva to the only kid, one of 2 children that slept alone. It's just ridiculous. No. So I don't know who did it. I think that there are people that know who did it. And I think due to the community, there's a lot of, I think that there are a few people that will never say anything. But the good news is that the case was reopened in 2013. And in 2015, law enforcement stated that they believe that a student or a faculty member was involved in Chaim's murder. And before that, it doesn't sound significant, but they would not commit to a person of interest in this case at all. So something must have happened. And then the last thing I have is that Anton Weiss was very excited about the case being reopened because he believes that now that these yeshiva students are older, married, and have sons of their own, maybe one of them will finally come forward because they understand the concept of the loss.
Wow. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah.
I mean, we can hope.
We can hope.
Ugh, God. That's terrible.
It really
is. Good job. What a way to end it here.
Would we end it any other way?
No. No.
We're dealt the cards we're dealt, y'all.
Y'all? Well, Allison, you did a great job, as
you
always.
We did it.
And listeners, you did it.
You did it.
Everybody did it.
You did it with us. 4 years, 4 seasons.
4 seasons.
Can you imagine?
Crazy. I can't even believe. I know we say it all the time, but we did not know we'd make it this long.
Okay, well, I mean, the Instagram's still going to be around.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might still, like, if there's crazy updates or something, I might throw them up there.
Right,
yeah.
We're not going to ghost you.
We still have some Googs alerts set.
Absolutely. Yeah. We love you guys. Ah.
We love you so much. Thank you for everything. You guys are the absolute best.
Truly the best.
And I don't want to cry again, so.
Goodbye.
Signing off. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
You're far away from your mic. I'm scared, Allison.
I am?
A little bit. I think it just sounds, I mean, we're hearing her computer mic. Oh, sorry.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And you got that limp.
I got that chunky line. I'm good.
But you got those limp mics, so I don't know.
Oh, I got this limp, bitch.
I love to picture that that's how you're dealing with any limp dick you've ever been.
No, what I usually faced with.
Just flick it. Okay.
No, I usually just like give it a little, how's your father?
Oh, I love doing the intro. It's so fun for me. Okay.
It's only fitting that this is the worst intro ever for you.
We never have to do it again.
Eliza and I always talk over you during the intro.
Okay.
And then I cut it.
I'm quiet.
How we do this.
I'm not going to talk about how I treat a limp dick anymore.
Okay.